I'm surprised that the gifts that are here, musically in particular, both performance and vocal. Anyway, I trust that there will be a careful development along the way of young people. For those of us who are older, we have to ask what we should be doing. How are we maintaining our health? This is a very important factor. Mr. Armstrong himself died at 93 and a half. There are many who never reach such an age. So we do need to take good care and to know how to maintain good health. Now I want to, this is my observation of the general state of the congregation and I think the things that we need to bear in mind as a group for all these different ages and your various backgrounds. I've been asked, in a sense, could you explain in some way what we ought to be seriously looking at in terms of the world around us or where we are in the lifetime of this generation, where we are in the revealed prophetic sense. Where are we, in other words, if we were to look at the prophetic books of the Bible? What is on the horizon? I will give some comments so that we understand. If we see before the coming of the Messiah to establish the kingdom of God on earth, to bring peace in a world with trials, we have to recognize there are events that lead up to that. Today, we live here in what we may call comparative peace. Comparative because there are always trials. There are trials called accidents on the road. There are trials pertaining to health. Now, we have not had a situation where we would be riding a train only to find that the car of, let's say, a streetcar, an underground, is blowing up in our face, or we're getting at a certain kind of poisonous gas, as in Tokyo some few years ago, was released. You've all, of course, heard of the tragedy that beset Madrid, Spain. These things can happen anywhere. We simply have been free of that. New York had the terrible destruction of the two towers. But let us face it, Jesus said, made it very clear, that nation against nation and people against people will continue. He did not say that we will all around the world have peace and then suddenly insanity breaks out. He is saying that nation against nation and people against people is a fundamental characteristic of humanity. Hardly a year goes by that is free. And in recorded human history, as distinct from the unrecorded, but in recorded human history, only a few years have a record of freedom from war. In the year that Jesus of Nazareth was born, the temple of Mars at Rome, the god of war, was shut. One of the phenomena of the Roman society, the temple of the god of war was shut because the Romans did not need to consult the god of war. They were at peace with their neighbors. Christ, the Messiah, was born at a time of peace. But his life in the flesh ended in a period of developing crisis in the kind of trial he was given, the kind of punishment, and his execution. Now, when we tend to think of prophecy, we tend to focus in a particular area of the world. To say that events have yet to unfold in the Middle East, yes. They have yet to unfold in Europe, yes. They have yet to unfold in Europe's perspective of Eastern Europe and Northern Asia. All that's future. But look what's even now taking place or has taken place. I would like to mention to you that I had an unusual experience in 1957. I was planning to go to Nigeria, to the Congo, and then to go to Khartoum, the Sudan, and to Cairo. That is that route. I went with another person, doesn't matter who was with me at the time. We went from the airport to New York to pick up our passports. In those days, you sent the passport away. It was stamped to give you the visas, and then you picked them up near your city of departure. A gentleman was standing, also waiting to go, and he looked at the two of us, and he said, "Would you like to have three in a taxi?" And of course, you know, that cuts the price. So we went, and he asked, you know, or I, whoever did, I think he asked where we were going and what we were likely to do. I asked what he was interested in, and he said he's a writer of travel books. Well, you know, immediately I wanted to know. And I told him what we were going to do. I had planned also in between to visit the old German colonies of Rwanda, Burundi, that passed to the Belgians after World War I. And he said, "Well, based on your trip, you must spend some extra time in Rwanda, Burundi," which we now call Rwanda and Burundi. We did. I listened to him. He said, "That's one of the most remarkable places that you can visit in Africa." So, on the way from the Congo, we were to land in Rwanda-Burundi area, and then what we had planned to do would be to go to the capital of Uganda, Kampala, Entebbe is the airport, and then come by car. As it turned out, our two-motor plane landed with only one motor operating, felt safe, and then we had a chance to spend three extra days because the engine was not repairable, and they had to send a new one from Belgium. So we spent three extra days there, and in addition came back by way of the car from Uganda all the way through Rwanda, Burundi, and the Eastern Congo. Now, I would like to say we don't all have the opportunity to see something in advance and to have an understanding. But you know, one of the most tragic civil wars that occurred since World War II, a kind of Holocaust that took place in Rwanda, and a semi-problem of that nature in the Republic of Burundi, and then the civil war that has affected the Congo. Our pygmy friends that we have helped through the pygmy fund established by Jean-Pierre Allais that the Ambassador Foundation worked with for many years has made it possible to have a forest set aside where they live, and it's in an area that most people who are warring in the Eastern Congo have not had access to, because it offers nothing other than to people who live in it. It's not mineral rich, it's not on the crossroads of commerce. So we are grateful that they have survived there, and I will publicly state that very sadly, Jean-Pierre Allais died only a few months ago of the many diseases that struck him, and yet he survived. We should ask God to protect those people in the Ituri forest. But the reason I'm mentioning this, there is a very, very serious problem still in that part of the world. A serious problem still in the area of West Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, a new problem in the Darfur area of the West Central Republic of the Sudan. In other words, there is not very much peace in certain areas of Black Africa. Before that, we've had the awful tragedies of perhaps one quarter of the population of Cambodia being butchered. It's the only way to describe. Anybody with glasses in Cambodia was put to death. You know why? You must have been reading, and reading must have distorted your mind. The Cambodian communists started out by putting to death anybody who had any external characteristics, and glasses were the quick standard they first worked with. Madness. Now look what happened in the tragic area of Afghanistan. Look what is happening now in Iraq. We have to face the fact that there are wars and rumors of wars, and because we are at peace in our local community doesn't mean others live safely. We have civil strife seriously in parts of the Philippines where we have brethren. In Myanmar, that is the new name for Burma, we have countries where there is peace, happily. So I would like you hear the news, you read the news, to give thought in your prayers. We have a small group, and we regularly pray before we have a Bible study about people whose problems we have become aware of. But really, our focus in a local small group meeting like that has simply been individuals. We would only be praying if we tried to pray for the whole world. We would never be doing anything else. But I think it important that you look beyond the local horizon here and realize the stress where many of our brethren live. Right now, there are people who are refugees out of the Congo who are living in Kenya, living as illegals, and whose potential for survival in that country is simply dependent upon the government. I would certainly suggest that you not forget that there are many areas of the world. Look at a map, seeing the crises, sometimes laid out very clearly in National Geographic or otherwise, would tell you. Now, there is a chapter in the Bible I would like to bring to your attention so you know where we are in the general perspective. In 1922, 26, Herbert Armstrong came into contact with the Church of God Seventh-day membership in Oregon. And because of his training, what he studied in the Bible, he wrote up in articles. The church said, why don't you submit them to the Bible Advocate editorial staff? And they saw he was an advertising man by training, could communicate, and they finally thought that it might be nice if he would explain some things that he was learning, because pastors were not necessarily there. And so as time went on, by 1931, he was ordained, and by 1933, the opportunity had arisen to get on local radio, and the local church had an opportunity to have its own program on radio in early 1934. And then in 1935, you know, events are moving ahead in the world. This was the center of the Great Depression. And in 1936, a crisis was developing between Italy, the Emperor of Italy, the Prime Minister, Mussolini, and the Emperor of Ethiopia. And the Italians were interested in obtaining Ethiopia to expand their empire. They had Libya, they had Italian Somalia, they had Eritrea. Ethiopia was the only country in the Horn of Africa, the east central part, which had never been made a colony. The only country in the whole continent of Africa that had not been forced into colonialism. It was the remnant of the Kingdom of the South, which once included Egypt, portions of the Sudan, and portions of Ethiopia. This was the area of the independent remnants of people who gradually migrated south upward into the mountainous region, as the Roman Empire had pushed these people further south. And they had maintained their independence. And Mr. Armstrong came on the scene at a very important time. You see, in World War I, 1914-1918, it's history for some of you. It was history for me. My parents lived during that time. Italy, Austria, and Germany had a pact. France, England, and Russia. And France, in particular England and Russia, wished they could break Italy away from the pact. And what happened is that they persuaded the Italians to join with France, Italy, and Russia. In the First World War. And after the signature was an addendum. We call it these secret agreements that are never published and only open to the public 50 years or so, or 75 years, whatever the time may be, and then you discover what was done. But the British in particular offered the Italians a free hand in East Africa. The implication was, for joining the Allies in World War I, they would be given the opportunity of colonizing Ethiopia. We should speak plainly. The documents historically are there. As it turned out, Italy suffered significantly in the war and was not prepared to do anything. Now, earlier, in 1895 to 96, in the winter of the autumn to winter of 1895 to the winter and spring of 1896, a crisis had developed in which the Ethiopians pushed back the Italian colonial army that was interested in penetrating Ethiopia from Eritrea. Eritrea is to the north on the Red Sea. And the Italians sought then to push back the Ethiopian resistance. The Italians created a significant army, and the shock came that the Ethiopians completely demolished the Italian army, the most significant defeat any colonial power received from another country. Neither the Spanish, nor the French, nor the British, nor the Germans ever had such a humiliating defeat as the Ethiopians dealt the Italians out of Eritrea. This is one reason the Italians were willing to consider breaking the alliance. But nothing happened. And now Mussolini came to political power. The emperor was still the king of Italy. Mussolini was not the king. The emperor was the king. Mussolini came to power. The Depression came. 1935 came, and then 1936. The Italians demanded the right to pass through the Suez Canal. The British were in an awkward position because now they didn't want them to, but they had, in a sense, given the implication to the Italians that they would be given a free hand in Ethiopia. Mr. Armstrong explained all this on radio as it was happening. Mussolini demolished and overthrew the government. The Italian armies took over and created a vast East African empire. Ethiopia was completely absorbed. There was no independent nation left. All this was on radio. And one of the famous names in the church, Mr. Basil Wolverton, was one who heard it and was astonished that what Mr. Armstrong was saying was in fact happening, and Mr. Armstrong was reading a story here about a king of the north and a king of the south. Daniel 11:40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will lock horns with the king of the north, and the king of the north will attack him with chariots and riders and many ships. Now, they locked horns in 1895-96, and in 1936, the Italians attacked with what we would call modern weaponry and by ships that came by sea. He will invade lands, sweeping through them like a flood. He will invade the beautiful land, too, and many will fall. I'm getting ahead of the story here. Yes, the Italians succeeded with Ethiopia. At the end of the statement, the chariots and riders and many ships. Mr. Armstrong showed what was happening there. Then the Italians and the Germans made an alliance, and they started to invade Egypt out of Libya in North Africa. And the Germans and Italians under Rommel swept through the border of Egypt all the way, and there was Cairo in the distance. And in front of the German army was also the British pipeline that was to carry water. The Germans arrived at the very point when that pipeline was being tested by salt water. And the Germans and Italians shot holes and started to drink the salt water that they thought was fresh. And you know, when you drink too much, you start to feel green and turn purple. And they never got further. It was one of the miraculous events of that small thing in history. But the war continued elsewhere, but they got no further than the fact they would invade lands. And the Germans, of course, went west to Tunisia as well. Now, Mr. Armstrong later came to see that the story stops, essentially, with the fact they got nowhere. He started to, in this King of the North, to invade lands, sweeping through like a flood, even the beautiful land which means Palestine. That is the border, now the state of Israel and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So Mr. Armstrong saw that the story had stopped there. It was not allowed to go any further in the Middle East. Even if the war didn't end, it actually receded. Now, I would like to make an explanation here, which is really the reason I'm giving it. When the ancient kingdom of the north, which was Syria, Syria was north of Palestine, Egypt was south. That is, if you look on the eastern Mediterranean. That is, the land of Judea was in the middle, Palestine, the area up north was Syria, and the area south was Egypt. When the Romans took over and conquered Syria, in 63 BC, the independent kingdom of the north ceased to be Syria. Rome was the government. And the church had understood. The church does not address the question today, doesn't choose to address it in the sense of right or wrong. It just simply does not address the question today. Worldwide does not. But it is important to know what the church did teach in this sense, because the important thing is that when Syria was absorbed, the kingdom of the north, the government of the kingdom of the north, passed from one or more of the major cities of Syria to Rome. Is that clear? See? There was, therefore, a king of the north. Now, when the independent government of the kingdom of the south in the days of Haile Selassie was destroyed, there was no longer a kingdom of the south there. The government had passed to Rome. I want you to think about that. It is commonplace in our fellowship, commonplace in other fellowships that are broken away, to anticipate a conflict somewhere in the Arabic East African area, and people are trying to ask, well, what could be the kingdom of the north and what could be the kingdom of the south? And they start to read in Daniel chapter 11, verse 40, and they think that chapter 11, verse 40, the first section that I read, at the time of the end, the king of the south, the time of the end then begins, 1895-96. Would lock horns with him, this is a Jewish translation, but the king of the north later would attack him with chariots, riders, and many ships, and that's where the prophecy stopped, at the end of World War II. At that point, there was no longer a kingdom of the south. There is not now a continuity of that. What you find, it's very important, is that when this area is referred to again in verse 43 in its geographic details, it speaks of the king of the north in verse 43, and what does he find in East Africa? He does not find a kingdom of the south. He finds Egypt, he finds the Libyans, and the Cushites, Jewish translation of the names there. You may find others, in, depending on your translation. But in verse 43 are three East African peoples or countries, the region that we would today call Libya, Egypt, and the Sudan into Ethiopia. The one thing I want to bring to your attention, because everywhere I hear prophecy being discussed, people are looking for who the king of the south will be. The king of the south was swallowed up by the king of the north. And even though they withdrew, this part of Africa will never again be united. We do not look for a king of the south. If there is any government that is properly called the king of the south, it belongs as one of the titles to the king of the north that absorbed the king of the south. Therefore, a lot of speculation has been going on needlessly about a kind of Arab world. Who could be the leader? Those people will never get together. Let's be plain. If Sunnis and Shias cannot, and Iraqis and Kurds cannot, and look at all the other nations, the Egyptians and the Sudanese and the Ethiopians and the Libyans will never get together. So, let us now say, in conclusion, that I want you to leave with the premise that we must not focus in an area and misunderstand it. It is important. There will be indeed an assault on the neighboring countries that began by Mussolini, with Rommel as the chief general, in World War II. But what will come will be an invasion of land sweeping through like a flood of water, a tsunami. The term for, you know, an earthquake in the ocean and the waves. Flood over the land. The beautiful land, too, will be invaded. Many will fall. This is a major assault. And these will escape his clutches, Edom, Moab, and the chief part of the Ammonites, which is description of a portion of southern Israel and the Heshemite kingdom of Jordan, in which also is Petra, if you want to have a town that you've heard about. In other words, the Jews will have to have a defensive area, and that will be centered in what was ancient Edom. That will be in the area that is south, not north. This will not be Galilee. This is in the south, what we would call the Negev. You know, that portion, if you look at the Sinai, it's that portion of Israel which runs along the border of Egypt all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba. May I take just a little more time? Not much, but I want to tell a story. Nelson Glick. That's all I want. It's a little more time. Nelson Glick, Jewish Reformed rabbi, was an archaeologist, died in 1970, born 1900. My wife and I both met him. I listened to one of his, well, more than one of his lectures. He let's say it was a paid agent of the government of the United States and walked all through those lands in World War II. Palestine was a British mandate. And he knew what everything was like, and the United States and Britain knew the state of affairs. When the question came before the United Nations as to the state of Israel, the Jews were asked, the Israelis we'll call them, but they were Jews then. There was no real state yet, see? The Jews were asked, do you want the agricultural Galilee? Or do you want the arid Negev with the port of Aqaba? Nelson Glick immediately answered, we will take the Negev and the Gulf of Aqaba. Abraham's nephew Lot would have said, oh, I'll take the Galilee. The Galilee is not defensible in war. I've had the privilege of being in the Negev in 1963. I was also in the company in 1971 of the first Israeli Governor General of the Sinai, who knew the Negev very well. It is a defensible area. I just wanted to bring it up. I myself have often just summarized Edom, Moab, and the chief of the Ammonites as the Heshemite kingdom of Jordan. Jordan has a good relationship with Europe. The Europeans would have no reason to involve themselves in Jordan. They certainly will have a reason of involving themselves in Libya, Ethiopia, the Sudan, and Egypt. But I think we have to face the fact that ancient Edom was in the Negev. Not all of it, the upper part in particular. And I think we have to realize that any assault on Israel, that the Israelis would have to withdraw to the Negev militarily. And don't think that they haven't made plans. Because in the end, the Jews will be fighting at Jerusalem, yet to come. But right now, I will conclude by saying, this is the middle, roughly speaking, of the first decade of the 21st century. We'll have more and more serious problems for the rest of this decade, however you want to start it, with 2000 or 2001. But the end is not yet. The end is not yet. You're 15, you'll be 20, you'll be 22 if everything goes right. I think it important that you realize we have time yet, in this decade, to get our lives in order, senior citizens to know what it means to approach the end of life, parents who will become grandparents, young people who must consider how they should develop their lives occupationally and in terms of marriage or children. I do not wish to address any further detail on the subject, but to say that it is very likely from all we know in Europe, all we know in Russia, the Russians will never get back on their economic feet to be able to swing their weight around, not even until about 2010. By the estimation done in 1990, that it would take that long for the Russians some 20 years to get their house in order after the collapse of communism. East Germany was to be integrated and would be economically viable, like West Germany, by 1995, and East Germany is not yet economically viable as that part of Germany that lies in the east of it. Europe is adding roughly 10 nations. We don't know quite how the question of Cyprus will turn out. After you already have Portuguese, Spanish, French, Italian, Greek, Danish, Finnish, German, Dutch, English, Swedish, how would you like 10 more nations, languages? Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian, 3 West Slavic dialects, Polish, Czech, and Slovak, which is essentially the same, Slovenia, Cyprus, Hungary. Imagine, and of course there's Malta, that's the kind of old Phoenician Canaanite language, though they would speak modern languages there as a trading center. What is being erected in Europe is a grand economic Tower of Babel. And you know, we're building a military tower, you know, a kind of great fort, if you please, fortress. And we're beginning to add such a country as Romania and others. Not everybody entering the EU wants to become a part of NATO. Norway wants nothing to do with the EU and long ago was a part of NATO. Romania is not coming into the EU, economically it's not viable. But it wants to be a part of NATO. We are developing another military Tower of Babel, partly weak and partly strong. If you think this, and then let's have a religious examination of Europe, the Protestants with all their divisions, the Orthodox in Greece didn't even pay respect to the Pope. They marched in the streets against his visit. Even the Muslims in Egypt never did that. If you think that there'll be a happy marriage between Orthodoxy and Catholicism, you're mistaken. If you think Catholic Europe will immediately be embraced by Russian Orthodoxy, just take a look at the spiritual state between the two churches in Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. The Pope had wanted to visit Russia and the government had no problem. Gorbachev visited the Pope. The Orthodox Church doesn't want the Pope to visit Russia. That's the answer. It is veritably a religious Tower of Babel, and the question is, do we want Turkey in this, a Muslim country? And what do we do with the Muslims in Europe? How will we decide, are we going to be a Christian European Union, you see? What is a Christian? Does this mean a non-Muslim, non-Jewish? Think about it. And if I may say something just in a little different way, if you are stable here, we'd be happy to be back in 2010. You get my point. The end is not yet. Awful things are still to happen to people and nations where God's people may be living here and there in the world. But the end is not yet. You'll have to look into the next decade of this century. But I can assure you, it will become clearer with each passing year. My wife and I are grateful to be here. We have heard about you. Heard about you with the hearing of the ears. And now we have seen you. Good-looking people, mature, and children. We will be leaving tomorrow morning, and God bless all of you in your responsibilities as you continue to seek Him.